Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, welcome to Q. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. Have a listen to this. I am a dark red lipo. That's a little bit of The Feminine Urge by The Last Dinner Party from their debut album, Prelude to Ecstasy. And from the first few seconds of that song, you can tell this is a band that is unique in the music world right now, and they're having a crazy year. They dropped their debut album, they toured the world, racked up accolades like being named BBC's Sound of 2024. This is a huge honor that folks like Sam Smith and Adele have had early on in their careers. But up until this moment, The Last Dinner Party were really known as a live band. They cut their teeth on the London bar scene, performing to small rooms, no more than 100 people. And then they released their first single and everything changed. As Nothing Matters, that's the song that started the snowball of success The Last Dinner Party has had over the past year. They've got Canadian tour dates coming up, and we wanted to talk to them, so we gave Abigail Morris, the singer, and Georgia Davies, bass player, a shout. They were on Zoom, and I have to tell you this, they were sitting at a table outside at a restaurant in New York City, sunny afternoon, they're drinking wine, and as we're talking, were interrupted a couple times by cookies and sake being delivered to their table. They are definitely living the rock star life, and it was fun to get a glimpse of it. Here's my chat with Abigail and Georgia of The Last Dinner Party. And just a heads up, as you might expect from a couple of rock stars out to lunch on a sunny afternoon, there are a few F-bombs. Thanks for being here and making time. You are on your first day off in a long time.
Yes. Enjoying New York City.
We can hear the cookies. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Well, I kind of wanted to start at the beginning of your journey as a band, because I read that you got started after seeing other bands in London and sort of feeling like something was missing from what they were doing. Maybe Abigail, we'll start with you. What's the story there? What were they missing?
Oh. I think in the wake of COVID, what was missing was a kind of sense of joy and playfulness. And everything was a little austere and a little kind of bleak. And I think, you know, there became this kind of idea that you couldn't talk about serious things in a pretty dress. And I feel like, you know, what we wanted to do was capture this communal, live, exciting feeling whilst also being incredibly dramatic and theatrical. And just because we're being a bit pretentious and a bit over the top, it doesn't mean that, you know, we're not acutely aware of our political surroundings and what we want to talk about.
Yeah, well, there's a real sense of occasion to what you're doing. And I understand that the aesthetic part of it was also a big part of your mission statement early on. Maybe, Georgia, you can tell me a little bit about like what you set out to do.
We did set out to do something for sure. Like before we'd even had a rehearsal, we kind of wrote a manifesto in just like pen and paper that we bought from the dollar store. And I think, yeah, we set out to achieve something that like was not, you know, like anything tangible, like get any awards or any accolades or record an album. It was more just about like being on stage, wearing the clothes that we wanted to wear, and performing in our kind of like most childlike kind of sense of theatrical performance. And for us, the aesthetics was kind of half of the entire equation. So, I mean, basically, we just wanted to dress up. Yeah. We just wanted to dress up in ball gowns
and
also shred on guitars. And, you know, we loved dressing up to go to gigs that we would go to. So we just kind of wanted to give ourselves and our audience an occasion to dress up, because there are too few occasions in your life where you get to wear a ball gown.
Yeah.
So we want to give that to people.
Absolutely. So what was it like? I know that you had sort of an incubation period because COVID happened and then you rehearsed a bunch. What were you doing during the pandemic when you couldn't get out on stage and perform for people?
Well, we were just like in the same room for like months and months and months. Because what would happen is we'd rehearse in like the couple of days that we had between lockdown and do the same song over and over again in like the basement of a music uni. And then we'd all be like locked down again and not being able to see each other, and then come back and do the same song over and over again. And I think that like that was what was unusual about us when we debuted, because we came out really, really well rehearsed and really kind of tight, which isn't a luxury afforded most bands, because you kind of, you form and then you cut your teeth very much publicly, kind of at every show. It's kind of a work in progress, whereas I think what happened with us is we'd been rehearsing for maybe a year before we even set foot on a stage. And I feel like that was one of the first things people commented on when we played for the first show to, like, you know, all our friends were like, oh, you're actually really good. Like,
yeah, you seem so well rehearsed. Yeah, it's like, yeah,
we are.
We're
doing
so well rehearsed.
Show me how to do as you do. Why do you show me how? And let me be your arrow.
Talk a bit on a musical level about what's going on, because your sense of melody is so interesting and it's exciting and probably very different than some of the music people might be hearing if they're frequenting bars and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
What are you drawing on in your sound? What are a few of the references that you're drawing on?
I feel like because our keyboardist Aurora, she is a classical composer, and to be familiar with classical music is to be a master of melody, I think. Like, so many classical composers were, like absolute masters of a hook. And to draw on that, like in the string arrangements and stuff that we have in our songs, comes from a classical background. But then as a wider group, we're also like significantly influenced by people like Queen, David Bowie, Kate Bush, people who also admired a melody but also used melody in an interesting way that didn't become pastiche or cheesy.
And the world, I'm turning inside out, yeah. I'm floating around in ecstasy, so don't stop me now.
I'm glad that you brought up Queen, because I know this is a lofty thing to say, but Abigail, I watched a show of yours, like there's a YouTube show from Paris in February, I think, and there was flashes that I got totally of Freddie Mercury and what it would have been like for people to see him. And
hell yeah.
Oh, that's so nice.
It's true though.
I mean, he's such a hero of mine.
He
is the performer. That's very kind of you to bring him up in the same sentence.
No, it's true. The way that you move, because you're so cool, but you're not trying hard, and the like elasticity of your voice, it's I don't know. There's you're really doing something special. You all are.
That's so kind.
Yeah. Oh, no worries. Can you describe your aesthetic a little bit too for people who have never seen you visually? We're on the radio now.
I mean, it's maximalist, I think, is that it's cool. I think the thing is with us is when we started out, I think people were quite eager to, as everyone is in the media, eager to pigeonhole us into this specific kind of Bridgerton, corset, Edwardian
period drama.
And I think that's one thing that informs us. But I think, you know, the thing about us is we're five different people with very different aesthetics that come together in a very cohesive way. And I think that's the kind of magic of this group. And I'm against using one word to describe an aesthetic, because us as a band, we're very kind of anti this this modern kind of move towards micro trends and kind of saying like, oh, we're coquette and we're
ballet core,
whatever.
I think the only word is maximalist
and just kind of true to ourselves, which we want to encourage. You know, like as we tour, we wear the same outfits over and over and over again. We're very kind of, we don't believe in the idea of you need to wear something different and fresh and trendy every time, because that's so boring and it's so un-individualistic. And we're, you know, and so I wouldn't be able to give you one word that describes our aesthetic apart from sincere and maximalist, because we're going to keep changing and we're going to keep evolving as our tastes change. And there's not one kind of micro trend or genre that describes it.
Yeah, like we did a show in Austin, Texas a couple of nights ago, and all five of us went full on cowboy. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that would necessarily fit into like the Baroque, Edwardian kind of labeling, but it felt very fundamentally dinner party as well. Yes, so
again, it goes back to the sense of like playfulness and childlike approach to style and music, in the sense of we don't discriminate or say, oh no, we can't do that, it's not dinner party. Because there isn't anything that's there's not
no rules.
Not dinner party. It's sort of like, oh, what do you feel like? Do you want to wear a bikini top and jeans, or do you want to wear a ball gown?
Yeah.
Or a cowboy, like, you know, it's
all encompassing.
It's just fun.
I wish I knew you back when we were both small. I wish I knew you, but I have gotten too tall. I wish I knew when touch was innocent. I wish I knew you before it felt like a sin.
I want to ask you about a show a couple years ago where you opened up for the Rolling Stones in Hyde Park in London. 65,000 people were there. And that's like what? Exactly, the sound that you just made.
Yes, they were.
Were you? And this was before you even had a single out. If I have that right.
Yeah, this was like it was so early in our careers that I still can't believe it.
Yeah, I didn't think about it.
It was me neither. I forgot.
How did that happen?
That was a weird blip.
How did
I don't know?
So the British Summertime Festival in Hyde Park is like, they always have a kind of new band open the main stage, like they have done for a long time. And we got a call from our manager in the middle of a rehearsal. I remember this very vividly, being like, you're going to think I'm like pulling your leg or whatever, but do you want to open for the Rolling Stones? And we were like, piss off. Like, stop pranking us or whatever. But no, it was legit. And we opened the main stage for the Rolling Stones, and we definitely did not deserve to be there at that point in our career.
And then got snubbed by Mick Jagger.
Did you say you got snubbed by Mick Jagger? What happened?
So we opened the main stage, and then it was Courtney Barnett, and then Sam Fender, and then the Rolling Stones. And when the Stones were on, we were all watching from the crowd, and it was amazing. And it got to the point where Mick Jagger was coming to the front and thanking everyone that had opened. And we were kind of standing there clutching each other, like, oh my God. Because he came out and he was like, I'd like to say thank you to everyone that's opened for us. And like, I remember like, and our friend was filming us because he wanted to get our reaction to Mick Jagger, like saying our name. We were calling each other like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And he goes, thank you to Courtney Barnett and Sam Fender. You've been amazing. Thanks a lot.
And we were like, it's the funniest video ever.
It's so funny. And like, because I think he had no, like, because obviously they had no idea who we were. We didn't meet them.
No.
It was just, he just had like, someone in his ear being like, American Express.
Yeah.
But now we have permanent beef with Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
He doesn't apologize.
His days are numbered.
There will be blood.
Well, I know he's a frequent listener to this show. I mean, Tom Power, the main host of the show, has talked to him before. So next time Tom talks to Mick, maybe we'll get him to raise it.
We can figure this out.
You know the Addy. But hey,
we're going Azalea Banks on him.
Before that happened, before you got snubbed by Mick, what did it feel like to step out in front of that many people and do your thing? What was it like?
I think I blacked out.
I don't remember a thing about it. Because it was, we'd never, because up until that point, it'd just been like pub gigs.
Mm.
And I think the thing about it is it was so scary, but also it then became very kind of fine, because once you're up there, you couldn't see anyone.
Yeah, it was too far away.
That's the thing, like, we were on the massive stage and it was really cool. And then it was just loads and loads of people, but you couldn't see. So I was like, oh, we're just doing a rehearsal on a massive stage at the tree. So it was kind of
it's very
fine.
Funny because, like, sometimes my photos, I'll get like a memory of it in my like Apple photos or whatever, and we because we'd only ever played tiny stages, we all stood so close together.
Aww.
And it was the bit, and it was the biggest stage probably we'll ever play.
Yeah, we haven't played
to this day
yet, so.
But we all stood super close together because we didn't know how to use a big stage. No. We only ever played to 100 people in a pub in South London, and then we were on the biggest stage of all time.
Yeah.
So we just stood next to each other.
I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You're listening to Q. More of my conversation with The Last Dinner Party coming up.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Okay, I want to play some more music. So the year after this happens, in 2023, you release this song as your first single. We're going to play a bit of it. Here we go. That's Nothing Matters by The Last Dinner Party. That song had a huge viral moment on TikTok. It was included in so many Best Song of the Year roundups for 2023, millions of streams. But something that's really struck a chord with people listening to it is the way that you write about rage and about female or non-binary people taking control of sexuality. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're trying to get across in that song?
Oh my God, I love this question. This is really funny because I wrote the lyrics for that song. And I did not think about this when I wrote them. Because when I wrote them, every single word, every single line just kind of came out very quickly and very easily. And there wasn't a lot of consideration and massive kind of planning and thinking. And, you know, it was just kind of what happened. And it's only as time has gone on that I've noticed how important the lyrics are, especially the chorus, because as it's the biggest song that we have, it's the one that we have to play the most. And we often have to play it on television or radio where we have to censor the chorus. And so we say, I will have you, instead of I will fuck you. And when we started doing that, we didn't think that much of it. We were just kind of annoyed that we had to change it, but we were like, oh, it's fine. But we noticed often I'd see comments on those versions being like, oh, like, it doesn't hit the same. Like, this isn't as good. Why are they saying have? Like, what's this? And it kind of made me realize that I think the biggest appeal of that song is that lyrically hearing a young woman say, I will fuck you, is like, I didn't think about it at the time,
it's very unique. It's it's kind of a confronting thing to hear, because you never hear that kind of sense of sexual agency in pop music from young women. Like the kind of taking power of I will fuck you. Like that's a really kind of unusual sense of sexual autonomy. And I think that like replacing that with a more palatable word does the song a disservice.
It really does. I hate doing it. And I think, you know, it is like a, you know, it's like we're in the age of like sexual agency, sexual autonomy. And I think it hadn't quite reached the alternative rock scene, which is where we're at. So really, we're not doing anything super new in sense of, oh, women want sex. Well, crazy, because, you know, people are doing that in the mainstream. But I think where we come from, in the kind of
like the indie alternative,
South London, having that kind of voice of women being actively fucking instead of passively being fucked, I think really reaches people, which I didn't think about when I wrote it, because it just made sense to me to say that.
I heard somewhere that Courtney Love had like a suggestion of a radio edit for you on what it should be. Was it any good?
No, it was not very good. But I actually, looking back and like saying all that we've said about why the word fuck is super important, I think she understood that, because her suggested replacement was punch.
At the time, we were like, fuck,
what are you talking about? Like,
no,
like Courtney Love, like, what are you on? But in retrospect, I think she actually understood the assignment of the song better than anyone, because it is about something kind of agency and like doing something to someone else, you know? Like, I think she actually kind of understood
she got it.
And we didn't realize at the time, but she got it.
The thing that pisses me off the most about what we've done, which is Have, is so many people think it's a hug. And that makes me want to quit music forever. Because I'm like, why would we ever say
hug? I will hug you, like, nothing matters.
It's giving kids bop.
Yeah.
Like, please don't quit music. We are correcting it now. Nobody's saying hug.
No hugging allowed.
That's
no,
so
we're
funny.
A hugless band.
You know.
I just want to ask before you go, because I think that you've got so much ahead of you. What do you hope that the next year looks like for The Last Dinner Party?
Sincerely, everything I've ever hoped for has come true. Mm. And that's such like a, I don't know, it's a weird thing to say. But it truly has. So everything going forward, it will just be like nice and a bonus, because like being able to write and perform music for a living, that's surpassed any expectations that I have ever had for my own life. I thought that being a musician was equivalent of being like an astronaut. Like, it's like completely unachievable and high in the sky kind of unrealistic dreams. And now that I'm sitting here in New York and I am a professional musician, so literally anything that happens going forward, I'll just be stoked about. My hopes for the next year will just be to keep writing, keep being creative, keep following our noses down different creative avenues, continuing to be curious and not perturbed by any expectation but our own. We'll see.
Yeah.
That's the real deal right there. I think that's what that is. Congratulations on everything, and can't wait to hear what's next for you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
A bit of The Feminine Urge by The Last Dinner Party. Before that, you heard my conversation with Abigail Morris and Georgia Davies of The Last Dinner Party. Their debut album is called Prelude to Ecstasy. It is out everywhere now. They're also on tour right now. They'll be playing in Montreal on March 29th and in Toronto on March 30th. And that's it for Q today. Tomorrow on the show, you can catch James Ennis.
one of the most sought-after violinists in the entire world. He's played with some of the best orchestras in the most famous concert halls. He'll tell you about his life in music, being a child prodigy in Brandon, Manitoba, and why, if you are one of the best violinists in the world, maybe you shouldn't play pickup basketball with your buddies. I don't know. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. I'll see you next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.